this is what Sunday? Palm Sunday. Yes, I was expecting to see palms all over the place, and that everyone got your own personal palm when you came in. So while we were singing, we could all kind of do this kind of thing. You know, I know it's you know ditzy, but we do it anyhow. You know, but it would play to the theme of things, and I want us to go there. So. In kind of preparation for this, I'd like you to already find your way into the book of Luke. Okay, the Gospel of Luke, chapter 19. That'll just save us some time later. Make your way there. While you're doing that, let me kind of create the scene a little bit or create a picture for you to kind of work with a bit. It has nothing to do with the scriptures right away. It's just a picture. Literally. I don't know if you've ever heard of a guy by the name of Julian Beaver. No. Okay. Don't look him up now. Look him up later. I know some of you are going to go, oh, let's see, Julian Beaver. Okay, don't do that. Instead, kind of keep your eyes up here. We'll talk about Julian. Let me tell you about this guy. He is he's a street artist. He's one of these guys that goes out on the street with chalk and he'll create these pictures on the sidewalk. You've seen guys like that, right? Create these beautiful pieces of art on the sidewalk. But his are truly unique because, for one thing, they're big. I mean, they would probably cover this whole area up here. But if you came upon him doing one of these things and you kind of looked at his artwork, initially you'd look at it and say, you know, I'm not sure he's that good because it would look all distorted. You know, things are kind of long and stretched in different places, and there's things in odd. You know, and you look at it and go, you know, I don't know, man. But that's because he has designed this in such a way that the picture only looks right if you see it from a unique perspective. You have to come around to one particular point, and he'll have a camera set up there. And you have to actually look through the camera lens on a particular angle, and you look out into this thing, and suddenly it pops, and it actually becomes three-dimensional. It's an amazing piece of artwork. But it only looks right if you see it from the perspective of the one who created it, of the author himself. You see where it's going already? So you guys go, oh, I already know where this is going. Okay. Good. Hang on to that picture here. Because today I want to take you into an account that is probably in some ways very familiar to everybody. But it's one that I'd like us to kind of get another layering deeper into as we walk through this thing. Because I want to take us back to Palm Sunday and look at that account. Now, as we're going that route, part of what is happening here is the idea that for 3 years, Jesus has been teaching about the kingdom. He's been the rabbi. And he's talked about the kingdom. That's his big theme. You know, he talks about what the kingdom is like and about how we function in the kingdom and our roles in this and what kingdom, you know, people in the kingdom do. And all this has been kind of creating this picture. He's been talking about the kingdom. But on this day, he adds another piece to it because now they're not just talking about the kingdom. They're going to talk about the king of that kingdom. And he presents himself into the picture as the centerpiece of that picture. Because here's the deal. Kingdom living is not about doing certain things. Kingdom living, that life that God has called us into, kingdom living is about the King. And that understanding changes the whole picture. It's when we come around and we look through the lens and we see it from His perspective that suddenly all comes alive and makes sense. From any other perspective, it kind of looks distorted. So with that, we come into this account here. You at Luke 19 yet? I don't hear any pages turning. I don't see anybody punching numbers. You must be there. Okay. Luke 19, we're actually going to pick it up in verse 28. Now, even though we're going there, let me create just a little bit more setting. Because just prior to this happening, some things have been going on that all lead to this. You kind of go back a couple of days and you would find yourself in the city of Jericho. And in Jericho, there have been some healings that take place and some exciting things going on. A blind person receives sight, and someone who is kind of one of the least loved people in the area, a tax collector by the name of Zacchaeus, is now been restored. There have been all sorts of things going on, and a crowd is building. He's going towards Jerusalem, and there's this crowd that starts following him. And they make their way to Bethany. And that night before this happens, they're in the house of a guy by the name of Simon the leper. That kind of tells you about what he was like. He's not the leper anymore. He still goes by that name because that's what his life was like. And around the table that evening is not only Simon, but there's a guy that was dead recently. Lazarus is at the table. And around that table there is a woman that has been healed, and demons have been cast out from her. Mary Magdalene. It's this incredible gathering of people. And from that, as this sets up here, there's this gathering of people that keep following Jesus, and they start to now move toward Jerusalem on this particular day. And that's where we jump into the account. And as we read through here, I want you to notice something. Something that I hadn't really noticed before until I was studying this past week. That the story has movement that is actually separated or announced, each part of the movement is announced, by the word approach. And with each approaching, it takes on a new dynamic. And in each place, we discover something else about the king. Because remember, kingdom living is about the king. And so we get some insight into the king as we move through the story here on this particular day. So, here we are. Luke 19, verse 28. It says that after he had said these things, he was going on ahead, going up to Jerusalem. Okay, they're on their way there. Then you find the first approach in verse 29. It says, and as he approached Bethphage, very familiar place, right? Probably never heard of that before. Probably read right on through this thing, partly because it's so hard to say. Bethphage. It means the house of figs, which probably tells you a little bit, you know, a little side piece, a little bit about the day and the area. This place is known for its orchards here. And there are fig orchards. And also in the area there are date trees, and there are olive groves, and there are vineyards, and it's springtime, and it's probably a day like this. Beautiful day. You have all this going on, and they're on their way. And as they approach Bethphage, it says, and Bethany, near the mount that is called Olivet, or the Mount of Olives, he sent two of his disciples, saying, go into the village ahead of you. There, as you enter, you will find a colt tied on which no one has ever sat. Untie it and bring it here. If anyone asks you, why are you untying it? You shall say, the Lord has need of it. So those who were sent went away and found it just as he had told them. They untied it. People asked him, what's going on? And they said, the Lord has need of it. Now, here's a fascinating piece in this. I think when Jesus sends them ahead, he doesn't just say, go find me a donkey. Instead, it's like he gives them the whole script. Because he knows everything that's going on. He's the only one who knows everything that's going on. But he actually says, okay, look, here's the deal. When you go into town, I want you to go to Bethphage up here, and I want you to go to the corner of Main and Fifth. Okay? And right there, you're going to find a donkey and a colt. I mean, a full-grown colt. Okay, right, they're going to be tied up right there. Trust me, they're right there. Now, when you go there, here's what's going to happen. You're going to start to untie them, and somebody's going to come up, and they're going to ask you, so, Ben, what are you doing? Now, here's what you tell them. Just say, the Lord has need of it, and they'll go, cool. And you bring them back. In other words, he gives them the whole script of what to do. And they walk off. And it says it happened exactly the way he said. In fact, Matthew, when he records the account, gets even more specific on it, and he says it happened exactly this way, which is an interesting thing. He tells them what to do. The whole script, they go, and it happens just that way. And they bring this back, this colt back, a donkey. This plays a significant part here, because this is the donkey that he's going to ride into Jerusalem. And I'm thinking, donkey? I mean, this is my Lord, my King. He's riding in. We call this kind of the triumphal entry on a donkey. Because my picture, maybe your picture is different. When I picture donkey, I think stupid. Right? I think of all the animals that you could pick. And of all the animals on earth. Donkey? I mean, is that right? I mean, donkeys are kind of dumb animals and stupid looking and big ears. And that G.K. Chesterton wrote a poem about this very thing here. And he said, God, really? Of all the animals, it seemed like on the day that you made donkeys, something was wrong. but that's our picture. That's at least my picture. Kind of a Western view. At this particular time, in this realm of the world, the donkey wasn't viewed that way. In fact, the donkey had kind of a symbolic nature to it. It was viewed as an animal that kind of characterized the whole idea of humility and gentleness. In fact, it goes all the way back as part of a prophecy in the book of Zechariah. Because in Zechariah, he speaks out into the future of the day that this would happen, of this very day. He says, behold, your King comes, gentle, humble, riding on a donkey. These disciples, when they went and got this donkey, had no idea this was going on. In fact, it records that, not in this particular passage, but I think it's in John's account of this. It says they had no idea what was going on. They were just doing what the master said. It wasn't until later they go, works. But in this idea of riding out a donkey, we learn something about the King. Because Jesus could have come riding on a horse. There are two ways that a king would come and announce himself. One would be riding on a stallion, cape flowing in the back. Sword out ahead. Yes! Now, if he did so, that would have announced a certain thing. A conquering king that comes to do battle. But he came riding on a donkey, which was, in the Eastern world, a way of a king arriving in peace. A king coming to somehow restore things. A king that was coming with a different mission in mind. As you read through the prophecy in Zechariah, it's more than what is just simply mentioned here. The extended account there talks about Jesus, or about the King coming as one who comes to forgive, of one who brings salvation, of one who ultimately establishes peace. Or from the Hebrew standpoint, shalom, that brings everything together, who makes things right as he forgives. And there's something learned about our King in this picture, that the King comes to forgive and to bring salvation. Now, when this happens, there's a degree to which these guys get it. In fact, all the disciples do, because notice what they do, that whenever they bring the donkey. It says in verse 35 that they took their coats and they threw them on the donkey and then at his feet. In fact, as they proceed all the way into Jerusalem, everybody starts to throw their coats on the ground in front of the donkey. And the picture that was here, I mean, this was a very common type of thing, that you would kind of acknowledge a king by taking off your outer garment, the one that kind of identified who you were. And that was kind of the way they dressed in the Middle East. They'd have kind of their regular clothes. And then you had kind of the one you wore that said, this is who I am. I mean, this is kind of, this is my stuff, you know. And so I know who you are by that outer garment. You know, and the wealthy people had a certain way of doing it. The Pharisees had a certain way of doing it. Everybody had kind of their thing. Okay. And so by doing this, what you were doing, it was a step of an act of humility where you would actually take off that outer garment and throw it beneath the king. So that now you are not identified as the main person. You are actually taking your identity and putting it in humility before the king. Now if you looked around, everybody kind of looks the same. Because that distinguishing mark is gone. So they did the right thing here in the sense that they acknowledged the king, but there's a piece missing because part of the picture is distorted. They're seeing it from these different angles here, and there's part of it missing. They don't understand the whole picture yet, even though they've got a lot of the pieces. From this first part of the story here, what we pick up is that we have a king who is a forgiving king and one who desires to restore with peace. Then you move farther in the story. Next part here, verse 37. As soon as he was approaching, there's our next word, next movement comes in. As soon as he was approaching near the descent of the Mount of Olives, the whole crowd of disciples began to praise God joyfully with a loud voice for all the miracles they had seen, shouting, "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord. Peace in heaven and glory in the highest." And this thing starts to really erupt at this point because everybody has somehow heard about what Jesus has done. This parade is moving and they start to shout. Now I've wondered as I think of this whole parade going on here, what that must have been like to see not only Jesus, but to see everybody else that was there. I wonder who was in that crowd, the ones that began following from Jericho and had accumulated as they went. I wonder if in that crowd there was somebody looking around and seeing things for the first time, Bartimaeus. I wonder if in that crowd there was a short, pudgy guy by the name of Zacchaeus, who is now restored as one of the sons of Abraham. I wonder if in that crowd, I'm sure of this, in that crowd there was Exhibit A, Lazarus, raised from the dead. I think of all these people who had experienced firsthand God's restoring and forgiving and healing power as they move through. And it says that they're shouting and they're praising because of what they had seen. In fact, if you go to the other accounts, everything is about what they have seen, either those who were firsthand, people who experienced it, or people who saw it, or people who heard about it. They're all praising and they're saying, this is what God has done. And part of what we pick up in this thing as they're shouting is the idea that they're announcing that this is the rightful heir to the throne. He's proved it to us. Not only is he the gentle king who comes to forgive, but he's also the very son of David who actually restores and heals and puts things right because of his reign. And they're shouting this, and they're praising God for this thing. Whenever I think of the people doing this, there's probably a whole bunch of different categories in this. I mean, like I said, there's those who experienced it firsthand. Man, they've got a story to tell. There are those who saw it happen. They've got a pretty powerful story, too. But then it kind of moves farther and farther out. There are people in Jerusalem that it says came out to meet them, particularly if you read the John account there. They start coming out from Jerusalem because they heard about this thing. They're kind of just the curious people. But they get caught up in it, too. And everybody is shouting and they're praising and they're singing a song that comes out of Psalm 118. And they add a word. Actually, they change a word. Because in Psalm 118 it says, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord." And they change it. "Blessed is the King who comes in the name of the Lord." And they recognize, to some extent anyway, this is what's going on. And there's this excitement and there's this praise going on as they move through. Now, not everybody's excited, right? You read the next lines. Because part of the crowd is made up of Pharisees. And this is very disturbing. Because, you know, they're thinking, wait a minute. And so they actually come to Jesus. You know, the parade's going along, and it's kind of like, you know, a ticker tape parade. You know, there's just all this, you know, this flurry of stuff going on. They're shouting, they're throwing their coats beneath Jesus. They're waving palm branches, which is actually from the other accounts that talks about them going and cutting down the branches and waving these things, announcing the king is coming. And these Pharisees in the crowd, they come up and they refuse to call Jesus Lord. Remember, they simply say, Rabbi. Now, teacher, you need to correct your disciples here. That this can't, you know, you can't have these people announcing that you're the king, that you are actually the Messiah. And Jesus' response is great. He says, I tell you, if these become silent, the very stones will cry out. In other words, rock music. Pretty good, huh? Yeah. I would have loved for a moment just to have everybody be silent. You know, I mean, have just sit, watch. And have everybody, you know, say, watch this. And the rocks start shouting. And back to normal. So there's not only those who are praising, but there's those who are opposing. But there's an interesting thing I noticed in this. Fascinating thing. That with all this going on, particularly with what they're saying, they're announcing, the king has arrived. Blessed is the king who comes. They're waving palm branches, which was actually a symbol of their national independence. All this is going on. There's the absence of some people here that fascinates me. Do you notice there are no Romans? I mean, this is treasonous. And yet there's no indication that there's a single Roman in sight. In other words, they have considered this person, Jesus, riding on a donkey, to be irrelevant. And they totally dismiss it. In fact, they dismiss it so intensely that later when Jesus is actually being tried, it never even comes up. And this would have been a great way to convict him. So remember the other day? They don't even mention it. I think within the kinds of things that you see here, there are different kinds of people represented. There are those who see and respond to what God has done, and there's the praising going on. There are others who oppose, who actually are upset by this news. And then there are still others who just simply ignore it and consider Jesus irrelevant. All three represented on this day. But as you move through, two things we've seen about the king. One is that he is the forgiving king that comes gentle and humble on the donkey. A second thing is that he is the healing king who comes and sets things right as he establishes his throne as the heir to the very person of David, to King David. But there's still another piece in the story. Because as it moves farther, verse 41, it says, and when he approached, there's another key word, and when he approached Jerusalem, it says he saw the city and he wept over it. Now, this part of the story seems to kind of not be highlighted much whenever I think of Palm Sunday. You know, when I think of Palm Sunday, you know, all the pictures. In fact, I rifled through a whole bunch of pictures. I went through, you know, I went to Google Images and all that kind of, every place I could find. And the pictures, the great paintings and all of Jesus are either Jesus kind of like he's zoned out, you know, riding on his donkey and a few people with palm branches. Or Jesus almost kind of like he's in a that ticker tape parade. Kind of like, you know what I'm saying? Okay. Yes, I know. I'm the king. Okay. And yet, you get to this part in the account, and something dramatic happens. Because so far, they've been moving, you know, down the road here, and they're going through these orchards, and they're going through the vineyard areas, and they're moving themselves along, and they come around the side of the Mount of Olives, and now Jerusalem is before them. And as Jerusalem comes into view, and they start to go down the hill and actually up toward the gate that they're going to go into, instead of Jesus going, "Yes!" says he weeps. Now, the term for weep here, you need to get this idea, is not the same word that was used when Jesus was standing in front of Lazarus' grave. When you're standing in front of Lazarus' grave, there's a word that's used there for him weeping that has to do with the idea of silent tears. When he stood before Lazarus' grave and he hears all these others who are crying out and doing all the kinds of things that went on with a funeral and someone like that, Jesus stands there and sees the devastation and has silent tears come down his face. But here, not that word. He's not riding along with silent tears saying, "Oh, I wish it was different." Instead, the word that is used here is a word that means to wail out loud, to cry out with lament, to grieve loud and boisterous sounds. That's the term. As he sees Jerusalem on this day, it says he weeps, and his crying out, the actual text is given to us what he says. He says, "If you had only known this day, even you, the things which make for peace." Now, picture Jesus doing this. Okay? Kind of life now gets altered in this picture, doesn't it? Because they're expecting Jesus to be going, "Yeah," and they look up and here's Jesus wailing. If you had only known this day, especially you, he says, the things which make for peace. Another thing about our King, not only is he the one who forgives and comes on the donkey, not only is he the one who heals and sets things right as the heir to the throne of David, but he comes as the very present King, the one who is here now. He comes as Sar Shalom, the Prince of Peace. He says, if you had only known, you who above all people should have known, because the picture was painted out before you. The prophet spoke. You of all people should have known and been ready to receive your King on this day. If you had known the things that make for peace. Choose this day who will be your King. But you've missed it, he says. That you did not recognize, the end of verse 44, that you did not recognize the time of your visitation. For us here today, as we're standing here in the midst of, before I drop something else, one of the things that fascinates me about this, I mentioned a number of things, but this is one of them. When he says this day, I believe that this tracks all the way back to Daniel. In Daniel chapter 9, there's a fascinating statement, Daniel 9:25. Jot that down. Check it out. Daniel actually sets a date out in the future when Messiah the Prince will show up. Says from a particular date that we know in history, particular date that we can actually identify, the announcing of the rebuilding of the temple. Says from that date to the actual coming of Messiah the Prince will be 62 weeks and 7 weeks. It's kind of an obscure terminology. But those who are much smarter than me figure this out. It's weeks of years, and then they take that and they turn it into Jewish years, and they account for a leap year. They do all the crazy stuff. And it's like looking at a spreadsheet when they do all this stuff. And I think, oh, great, you do that. Tell me what you find. And as they do all that and they figure out the actual years, or actual days, it turns out to be something like 173,880 days. If you track it from that known date in history back here, move all the way forward, it lands on one particular day. Any idea? Palm Sunday. It was on that day. They could have known exactly the day that Messiah would show up. If you had only known, but you missed it. So now, let me wrap kind of this stuff together here. Because that clock tells me I still have days to go. On this Palm Sunday, part of what comes before us is the idea that the kingdom is not about doing things. It's about the king. Jesus had taught about the kingdom and had fulfilled his role as rabbi teaching. But now he presents himself as king. And it's our picture of the king that forms how we actually function within the kingdom. Because it's all about him. A king who is the forgiving king. Gentle. Humble. The king who is the one who heals and puts things right, who establishes genuine shalom. The king who is very present. But he's also a king that you and I decide if he will be our king. Not just once, but on each day. This day will he be my king. Will I allow him to be the one who establishes shalom in my life, who brings together the pieces, who forgives, who heals, who sets things right in my life on this day? God calls us to move from our various perspectives and to come around and to actually look through the lens of the Creator and see the picture the way he has created it from the viewpoint of the King. As we look into it, let's pray.